Today, blowing the house down. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. How are you going?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. All the news is keeping me busy.
Plenty going on, and we're on the reserve internet today because the other one's just gone a bit wrong at your end. So I hope it's going to work all right.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, you know, I mean, there might be a little bit of a judder, a bit of a lag here and there, but hopefully it won't be too bad.
So I thought the title was quite funny, really, because, you know, I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow the blow the house down, right? It just sort of seemed to me that feds and, you know, Jackson Hole and putting rates up and housing sector just going through the floor. Well, interesting times once again.
It certainly is. It's been quite interesting to watch, you know, because we've gone from this sort of idea just before Jackson Hole, you know, which is the, you know, the big Fed jaw draw that they do every year, that, you know, that the Fed was going to turn dovish, that it was going to, you know, walk away from all this stuff and the market was certainly pricing that in for a start. But then now, you know, all of a sudden it's completely turned and about the risks of the US housing market, which, you know, I can't help but just have a nice little giggle to myself when I do the comparison between Australia and the US, because we're just in completely different galaxies.
Yeah, absolutely. In a galaxy far, far away. But what is interesting is that the trajectory of house price falls, of course, in Australia are increasing. I'm sure we'll touch on that. And in New Zealand as well. And in fact, Adrian Orr was actually over at Jackson Hole and was interviewed on Bloomberg. And he was still quite fixated on, you know, 4 to 4.25%, that sort of range in terms of the terminal rate for New Zealand. So they're going to continue to turn the wick up. And I guess the message from Jackson Hole that I took was, you know, inflation is our number one, number two, number three objective. We have to beat it. And if that breaks the economy in the process, well, so be it.
Yeah, I thought that that the RBNZ's comments were quite instructive in that regard. And there's been a few other people, you know, the deputy governors and the like, who have made similar comments over the last few days. And I find it quite fascinating because New Zealand is starting to show some of those signs of slowing down. You know, you've seen that 2.3% fall in retail sales in the last quarter. You've seen, you know, a quarter of negative growth, but the labor market is still very, very strong. And if you actually look at the partials of the retail sales data for New Zealand, a lot of that fall was driven by the lack of availability of cars. And also the fact that a lot of Kiwi consumers have had, you know, their fill of things like, you know, homewares, furniture, hardware goods, and that sort of thing. So, you know, really, I just think it's quite instructive that rate rises will continue even as we sort of see these, you know, deterioration in the economy for certain indicators.
Yeah, and it, you know, there is a bifurcation of data, right? So there's some data that's still quite strong. There's other data that's quite weak. But the fundamental question for me, Tarek, is when inflation is fundamentally being driven by high energy prices and supply chain disruptions, to what extent does putting rates up solve the problem? And I'm not sure anybody knows the answer to that yet.
No, I don't think they do. But I think at the end of the day, they're sort of, it's almost a little bit like the elephant in the room. You know, they know that it's there. They know that energy prices are the main thing. But at the end of the day, they're just going, well, what's core inflation doing? And core inflation, say in the US, is inflation with energy and food prices stripped out. Or here in Australia, for the RBA, it's the trimmed mean, which takes off the top 15% of price increases and the bottom 15% of price increases. So I think that they're holding very much to those particular metrics as their focus. And that, I think, bodes for more hawkishness, even if and when the headline rate of inflation begins to decline.
And it's interesting, of course, that we have no explanation from the Fed as to why they got it wrong over the last couple of years and, you know, no acceptance that actually maybe they made a mistake. So it's just, you know, new data, new trajectory, new direction, and we'll be data-driven.
Yeah, and I think that that's pretty much going to be how they go from here on. I don't think that we really have much idea as to what exactly the yardsticks will be, but very, very much focused on the labor market. Possible that we could see US unemployment rise by 1%, 1.5%, and there's no real, you know, guarantee that that's going to turn the Fed dovish.
No, absolutely. You've gone mini, but I can still hear you okay. So we'll carry on with our 3G backup internet for the moment and see how it goes. Okay, first world country problem, eh?
Yeah, well, you know, the NBN, you know, I think it really speaks for itself what a mess that is. But yeah, we'll move on.
Yeah, well, let's go to the slides because they're static, so maybe that'll be easier. Let's put that up. There you go. And I love the this one. This just summed it up so well.
Yeah, it really does. As usual, the charts are available at avidcom.substack.com. And just a big thank you to everyone who has made recurring donations, who has subscribed, who has supported me. It is really immensely appreciated, and it just gives me that bit of breathing room in the old finances so I can focus on stuff like this and more independent content. So without further ado, we'll get to the next set of slides. Now, this one's a particular favorite. It's the New Zealand housing prices versus Australian housing prices. And I've based this off 2 months before rates started rising in the respective nations. And interestingly, in New Zealand, in most markets, prices continued to rise, at least in the monitored markets that I monitor here, which are Auckland and Wellington. And this much worse trajectory than their New Zealand counterparts. The worst performing housing market in New Zealand in terms of their major centres is Wellington. And at this point in their rate hike cycle, at about 3 months in, a little over 3 months in, prices had only fallen in Wellington by about 2% from this particular baseline. But for Australia and for Sydney and Melbourne in particular, things are performing much, much more poorly. I mean, Sydney prices are down about 7% in that time. And, you know, it's, I believe, the fastest falls in housing prices in Sydney in 39 years.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And one of the things that I notice with all of this is that the rate of change of particularly fall is accelerating, and Sydney's leading the way. It's also, of course, spreading out more broadly as well. So we're in the situation where essentially the trajectory is down. And remember that there's a lag between interest rates hitting and house prices behaving, simply because it takes a couple of months for it to work through the system. So you have to expect prices to fall even further.
Indeed. And I mean, I think it's notable that August was the first month where for all five of the monitored capitals fell according to the CoreLogic numbers. And it just goes to show that the falls are becoming more broad-based. And also that, well, if you just do the math, if you go from the time rates started rising and you compare that to when the US entered the global financial crisis recession, Australian housing prices nationally are falling faster.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, rates are going to go higher. I mean, next Tuesday, the RBA is going to lift rates again, isn't it? So expect more of the same.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, I'm sure that we'll get to more interest rates later on in the chart pack.
Exactly.
Now, there is this narrative that is quite, well, shall we say, widespread that, well, interest rates were high in the 70s and the 80s and, you know, housing prices did fine then. Why would that be any different now? And this chart, which is ironically from a paper written by the RBA back in the mid-1990s, shows exactly why. Because unlike now, where wages growth has a two in front of it, back during the days of the early 1970s is what underpinned those rises in housing prices, and also the fact that why consumers were so relatively easy able to cope with both high inflation and higher interest rates.
Right. So your point is that back then we had wages growth. So wages growth effectively protected us.
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
Yep.
Clear. And if you look at the longer term, you know, the longer term chart, for the vast majority of the period that this chart covers, which is around about 25 years, wages grew faster than inflation. And that, you know, significantly faster. And I mean, you know, there are some people who, I mean, say, for example, like, you know, some of my in-laws' grandparents, they paid off their loan in a matter of years during the 70s because wages simply were growing so, so quickly. And that is what underpinned, you know, the housing market back then. But you can't pay off a house in years when you, when you, your wages are growing at 2.5%, or for a lot of people, not growing at all.
No, absolutely. It does make a huge difference. And of course, real wages growth really has been, well, zero since about 2011, 2012, which is, by the way, one of the main reasons why my mortgage stress numbers really are very relevant, right? Because they've been rising and rising and rising. And that is because essentially people have had a larger share of their income going in to support the mortgage because their real income has not been growing very, very fast at all. That's one of the factors in the current state of affairs. And that was despite falling interest rates.
No, indeed. And I think that's a key point that you make in the fact that, you know, we are only just at the beginning of these problems. You know, if you look at the numbers from Treasury, if you look at the numbers from the RBA, they are predicting worse outcomes for real wages. And as you say, real household outcomes have already gone back to 2011, 2012 levels. And they're going to go back even further by the time this is all over. And that really is concerning for a multitude of reasons. It's concerning because households have less money to be able to, you know, to get by, to spend, you know, on the basic necessities of life. But if you want to look at it, say, from a housing market perspective, that's a whole lot less of the old pay packet in real terms that you're actually able to spend on servicing a loan.
Absolutely. That's right. And of course, the loans are bigger because prices have gone so high and, you know, people are more leveraged. And even the latest ABS statistics showed that the average loan size was down very slightly, but in absolute terms, it's still very large relative to incomes. So we've just gone right up one end of the dial, and it's going to take some time for it to settle back.
Yeah, I think it's going to take quite some time, actually.
Yeah.
Now, this is an interesting chart from CBA, and basically it just shows that at a 2.5% cash rate, the share of total household disposable income going towards servicing housing-related debts is going to be roughly its highest level ever. And pretty much none of the major banks are now predicting a cash rate peak of 2.5%. They are now calling for, I mean, there's ANZ at one end of the spectrum at 3.35. So, you know, we are heading for that, you know, particular issue. And I think it's also worth noting that a much smaller proportion of Australians have a mortgage than Americans. So this debt is far more concentrated.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is this just households with mortgage, or is this effectively average across all households, whether they have a mortgage or not? Because that would change the numbers quite dramatically, wouldn't it?
I'm honestly uncertain, but it's, I mean, even if it is just households with mortgages, I mean, if you think about the households with these older, smaller loans, which make up a very large proportion of the overall loan book, you know, it just goes to show how challenging that could become, you know, relatively quickly.
Absolutely. No, it's a big deal. And as you say, ANZ at what, 3.35? And the ASX 30 is now 3.9% peaking middle of next year. 3.9. And that was significantly up from before Jackson Hole. So that's the yep. Powell effect.
It is the Powell effect, and it's also the retail sales effect too. It's the fact that, you know, retail sales come in very, very hot, a lot hotter than most people were expecting. And, you know, the Australian consumer continues to keep spending. And I think that it's really interesting as well, though, that from that the ASX rate futures data, that the peak in the cash rate has been, over the last couple of weeks, has been pushed back from April or May next year to sort of somewhere between August and October. So this idea of, hey, maybe there's going to be rate cuts next year, the market is starting to pour a bit of cold water on that.
Well, I think the thematics from Jackson Hole were higher rates for longer. That was my takeaway. And I think we're seeing it in all the markets around the world in terms of where the forward rates are now sitting. So, yeah, people are going to have to be paying more on their mortgage for longer. And that's going to have a very significant negative impact, I think.
Yeah, no, I concur. Now, this is an interesting one from the ABS, and this shows yesterday's housing finance data.
Yep.
So basically, you know, rolling over across the board. And, you know, this, I think that it's worth noting that this is for July. So this is only just the beginning. You know, this doesn't show the latest rate rise in August. And it's, you know, that we're still, I mean, if say, for example, hypothetically, ANZ are correct, we've still got another 1.5% worth of rate hikes to go, you know, potentially by, you know, as early as, you know, very, very early next year. So, you know, there's a long way for this to potentially fall, even just to get back to pre-COVID levels.
Yeah, let me just make the point here, Tarek, that, again, the lag, right? If you're applying for a loan, right, you have to put the application in, then you actually sign the paperwork and then you actually progress, right? So, again, there's still a lag. This is not actually reflecting all of the rate rises that are actually now in the system, which is why this is going to continue to fall, and I think fall quite quickly. And the other interesting point is that the refinancing is still very strong, so people are still trying to find lower rates alternatives, but eventually that's going to dissipate as well. So, you know, we are going to see maybe a retreat in new credit, you know, to levels we've not seen for, well, perhaps a generation.
Well, I mean, if that happens, housing prices are pretty much toast at that point, aren't they? I mean, yeah. You know, you think about what's going on at the moment, for example, you know, you're talking about Sydney falling at, you know, 2%, Brisbane 1.5, 1.7, Melbourne, a similar sort of thing. And, you know, obviously this is going to accelerate over time. But if you extrapolate negative credit growth, say negative credit growth via, you know, negative credit growth compared with pre-COVID, that's going to be a mess. You know, like that's hard to, that's really actually quite hard to imagine.
Well, it would fundamentally change the economics of the banks, who've been able to rely on credit growth as one of the you know, profit levers, even if the margin is being compressed even now, I notice. And there's some really funny things going on. So CBA discounted some of their new variable rate loans to try and bring more business in. They haven't necessarily passed on all of the rate rises to savers yet. So they're trying to sort of, you know, nibble at the margins to try and keep their margins high. But net margins are being compressed. So if credit goes backwards, then the banks are going to be in significant strife.
Yeah, they're going to have a fairly major problem, and only that, but they're also going to be hit by rising bad debts and bad debt provisions and the costings behind that as well. So,
right. Yeah,
you know, it's a pretty challenging environment if rates do continue their march higher.
So the really interesting question is, next time they report, what would their provisions be? Because they've been taking their provisions down over the last couple of years, right, to try and support their profits. Well, they can't go doing that in this environment. So watch this space.
Indeed, it's going to be interesting. Now, this is the retail sales report. Now, retail sales grew by 1.3% in July. Now, obviously, a sizable proportion are based on current prices, not on retail sales are. So, but still, it's still surprised to the upside, and Australians aren't really tempering their spending.
No, it's a big deal. The fact is, of course, that if you do adjust it, it comes back a bit, but it doesn't come back completely. But it's interesting, pretty much all categories were actually strong as well. It's quite broad-based.
It is, and I think that that's really quite fascinating, just that, like I wrote a thread recently, broken monetary policy. There are these people and these households who are in rising inflation, but then there's other households who may believe that, you know, as everything's going to be fine, etc. But you know, that is fundamentally changing the psychology of Australian consumers. And if we are seeing that fundamental change, and that is a, you know, sort of going to occur with some degree of permanency, and people are just going to spend more, rates may need to go a lot higher than otherwise.
Yeah, exactly right. It goes back to what we said, you know, in signs pulling in two directions, right? Some buoyant signs, some less buoyant signs. Sitting there with the interest rate levers, oh, well, if retail sales is that big, we need to put the rate up a bit more.
Yeah. And the problem is both are true, you know. It's like the K-shaped recovery. You know, you and I have been talking about that now for over 2 years, and that's exactly what's happened, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, this is one for our Canadian viewers. Canadian housing prices have fallen 9.9% from their peak, which is actually larger than their decline that occurred during the global financial crisis. So things are really starting to get interesting and now for our northern cousins, and their central bank shows little sign of pulling back on raising interest rates either.
And of course, the rate of decline, look how quickly it's dropped. That's the other factor. It's way quicker. And interestingly, if you look at the sales data from Canada and the stock data from Canada, it's behaving quite similarly to actually what's happening here as well. So it's clear to me that as rates rise, housing markets go the other way. You know, no surprise, availability of credit is the most fundamental lever relating to house prices.
Indeed, and I think it's going to be really, really fascinating to watch how all this unfolds, because in some ways, because of the RBA being caught behind the curve, we are seeing everything on fast forward. You know, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand started very, very gradually last year. Now, while they've worked their way up to multiple 0.5% rate rises, last year they were quite, you know, gingerly in beginning their rate rise cycle, where it's here in Australia, it's just been pedal to the metal right from the start. And, you know, there's not really a whole lot of sign that that's going to stop anytime soon.
No, well, they were late to the party here, of course, for all sorts of reasons. And they're still trying to catch up. And as we said earlier on, rates will go higher. So expect prices to ape Canada and New Zealand and continue to fall.
Well, I think a really interesting one is going to be if we see, you know, sort of a, I'm not going to call it a rerun, but sort of a sequel, you know, a bit of a different sequel for, you know, The Big Short 2.0 in the US, because there are a lot of people hitting panic stations over US housing prices at the moment. And, you know, if that starts becoming our news cycle, you know, if we start seeing, you know, these news reports talking about how, you know, this it's all happening again, I really do wonder how that could impact sentiment here in Australia.
I think you make a very good point there, because it's clear that the sentiment is one of the critical things that drives house price momentum. We know listings are up. We know that the number of people looking to buy is down. There are still some looking for bargains even now, although I actually would argue that there are very few bargains out there at this stage of the game. So it will be interesting to see. And, you know, once panic starts, that's when you start seeing prices begin to slide significantly, because then it's a scramble to the exit. Plus, of course, the banks then get into quite difficult situations. So do they encourage people to sell to try and get out to be able to pay off their mortgage, or do they go through foreclosure processes, which can take 2 to 5 years to sort of sort out? It can be very messy and very long, and could have a very significant and, again, negative impact on the property sector here.
Yeah, and I think that so far we've actually seen a distinct lack of panic in our market. You know, everything has been quite orderly. Like, we've seen these really sizable falls, you know, these multi-decade highs in terms of the speed of falls. Yet people are really, they're not really panicking. Like, but, you know, everything just seems to be sort of playing out quite, you know, quite calmly. And I think that that's really quite fascinating, that people are so, for want of a better word, comfortable with giving up the gains of the pandemic, because pretty much we'll say the last year of property price gains in 2021 was crazy.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you something. A lot of people are saying to me, well, you know, we didn't expect it to last because that 20% plus was not recognizable. But if we start seeing prices begin to slide back down to where they were before COVID and continue going down, that could be a tipping point. So we'll see.
Yeah, that is really the interesting one for me. Like, I think if we do get to that particular point and we do start to see, you know, prices fall below that, shall we call it, you know, a psychological floor, I really do wonder what it could take, if that could be enough to finally break the idea that negative cash flow property investing is a good idea. Because in a lot of other places, if you do that, people will laugh at you. Whereas in Australia, it's the norm.
Yep. Now, it could be a significant pivot point. And of course, the other pivot point is, well, will the Reserve Bank then change its tune because of the inflation thing? But, you know, if he follows the Fed's view that inflation is the battle you got to win, then even in a significant downturn in property, they may not actually change their trajectory with regard to interest rates.
I kind of get the feeling that in this particular instance, Jerome Powell is Sandra Bullock driving the bus in Speed, and Philip Lowe is just one of the passengers who's stuck on the bus.
Yep. Funny that. I've always thought that they take more of their direction from the Fed than anywhere else. And, of course, he's not the only central banker sitting in the passenger seat, right? So there's a few others there too, all sort of nodding and saying, yeah, 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 we have to do this. You know, look at the ECB, look at the UK, you know, look at New Zealand. They're all saying, yeah, 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 we've got to do this. So it is the current, you know, trajectory and speed being set by the driver, which is, of course, Jerome Powell.
Well, exactly. They've got to keep going, otherwise the bus blows up. So
exactly.
You know, that's just the way it is.
You can't stop. You can't stop. We've got to keep going. Keep going.
Now, I think this is a really interesting little comparison because, you know, there's so many people who just go, well, in 2008, inflation, you know, was what under control. You know, all it took was the world's biggest. If you actually look at inflation, this compares poor inflation between January 2021 and July 2022, and September 2008, which was the peak of inflation in the UK, is so much higher, is so much more entrenched. Wages growth is so much more entrenched that getting rid of it is going to be a lot tougher than it was when inflation in the US peaked at around, you know, 5.6%. Back in 2008, it's a lot harder because this time a lot more of the inflation is broad-based and not just energy and food.
Now, spot on. Bigger, more widespread, actually probably more entrenched as well. And it's going to be really tough, which is, of course, why, again, Fed Powell is saying, got to do it, got to do it, got to get inflation under control. But whether they can or whether they will redefine it. So did you notice at Jackson Hole there were a few debates there about, well, maybe we should redefine, you know, the target rate of inflation. Let's make it higher. That would be, you know, maybe more sensible. Let's change the rules of the game again.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've seen quite a bit of that. You know, like exactly at what point do the settings need to go through to say have, I don't know, say 3% PCE rather than, you know, 2% CPI. So I think it's going to be interesting, but I wonder if it's actually possible though. You know, like a lot of central banks have higher targets. So like the RBA has a target of 2 to 3%, whereas the Fed is just a flat 2%.
Yep.
Yet it doesn't really work like that because once inflation does get above 2%, once you start to see wages growth accelerate above 2%, the RBA whacks it anyway. It doesn't need to go to 3% for them to start getting out the interest rate lever and start pulling it. So, you know, I do wonder, although by the same token, you know, maybe, you know, that was the past. This is looking to the future. Maybe things will be different.
Well, just remember that, of course, previously they were saying, well, as soon as we start seeing it going above, we pull the lever. And then they said, well, we can allow it to go a little above a little bit because, of course, on average, it's going to be 2%, right? And now we're at the situation where it's, what, 8.5%, way above. So I sometimes come back to my central question is, do central banks know what they're doing or they're just playing with the numbers?
No, I don't. Honestly, like, I think that they have some idea, like obviously, like, you know, in very broad terms. But I think that all of this, particularly with the backdrop of changing geopolitics, reshoring, all these different factors, I think that there's now a degree of complexity to it that pretty much I think it's been entirely quantified yet.
No, I agree. That's really the point. I think we are in a somewhat new world. And I come back to my earlier point, inflation is being created by factors which are not necessarily the same ones that were created when Paul Volcker was trying to deal with it, right? It's a different set of parameters. So, well, we'll see. I suspect it's going to be a very interesting and uncomfortable ride for the next couple of years. And I think inflation will stay higher, interest rates will stay higher. And like I said, that'll push property prices further down.
Well, it's going to be really quite fascinating because pretty much no one is preparing for that. You know, no, like it's still very much an idea of, we're going to somehow get inflation under control. Like even if you look at the federal funds curve, which is basically how interest rates look out at a long-term perspective, you know, how it looks in 2023, 2024, 2025, et cetera. And there's still the idea that sort of sometime in 2023, potentially around about sort of June, July-ish currently, that you're going to start to see these rate cuts. But if inflation is going to remain higher, if we're going to have a second wave of, you know, there's obviously this first one in the year when there's, you know, the Northern Hemisphere and everything. But the question is there enough underlying inflation, the core inflation, to just keep powering back even after you see falling energy prices and stuff like that in, you know, say, for example, in year-on-year terms?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we will know in a couple of years, though, Tarek.
Well, it's gonna get interesting to say the least. You know, it's gonna keep me busy. I know that much.
Yeah.
Now, this is an interesting one from Nordea. So this shows basically a model that they've put together, which is the Philadelphia Fed leading index versus the operating earnings per share of the S&P 500, and they seem to seems to be pointing to a significant deterioration in earnings. Now, what's been really interesting so far is earnings haven't deteriorated as much as has been, you know, expected by much of the market. You know, part of that is passing on these large increases in prices, taking these actions to secure their margins. So it's going to be really, really interesting to see what we can't really afford to pay anymore. We're already paying enough.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had a chat with Damon Klassen earlier in the week, and he was showing the forward expectation of earnings, particularly in the US, and they're actually now dropping, and they're dropping quicker than previously. So, you know, whereas 2022 looks as though the earnings were probably quite strong, next year's earnings are already looking quite a lot weaker, and they're already forecasting lower earnings. So that will have a negative impact on the stock markets too.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that's really, you know, a big part of the story at the moment. Factors acting on the stock market. There's, of course, the Fed, there's tightening monetary policy, and there's, you know, quantitative tightening of that up this week and deteriorating economy. And I think that in some ways we've got a little bit of a perfect storm because the economy is holding up okay for the most part in terms of indicators like the labor market. We'll find out a little bit more later tonight with the release of the US payrolls data. But it's not falling apart quickly enough to give the Fed any sort of pause. So, you know, we could be sitting here in, you know, say 4 or 5 months' time where, you know, things have deteriorated for corporate margins, but the labor market is still doing okay. And that's really, in some ways, as sort of counterintuitive as it may sound, is a bit of a nightmare for the market.
Well, it basically means that they're not quite sure which way to bet, right? And what I find fascinating is that the number of people who are still saying, oh, there's going to be a Fed pivot coming, it's coming down, but there are still some people saying, no, they're going to pivot. So it'll be interesting to see as the data flows forward whether, in fact, the pivot mob disappear altogether or whether, in fact, the pivot mob just kicks it out slightly and then reasserts itself, because it's a fundamentally critical question, right? If the Fed is going to pivot, then the stock markets probably aren't massively overvalued. But if the pivot isn't there, then the earnings are going to be a lot lower next year and the year after, and therefore stock values are, well, probably 20% overvalued. So that's why prices could fall significantly.
Indeed. That brings us to something interesting in this next slide here. And this shows basically the estimated percentage of total volume, for US stocks, which is taken up by retail investors. Now, you know, if you look, you know, you can see there in sort of February, March of 2020, that you had that capitulation moment. You have significantly and very rapidly because the market crashed. Yet this time, that's not what's happening. We haven't seen a capitulation moment yet, despite the fact that we are, you know, in a technical bear market. So I think that that's really a key part of the narrative and of the story, that despite the fact, you know, that the market has taken these relatively large hits from its peak, the belief in the Fed or the belief that someone or something is going to come to the rescue of retail investors in the market more broadly still remains a very, very strong psychological driver.
Yes, and just remember, there was a lot of new investors who came into the market over the last couple of years. You know, their handout checks from the government through COVID and those sorts of things, some of that went into the markets. So there's a lot of inexperience out there. And there's a lot of people who are, as you say, expecting that the Fed will save them. Interestingly, some more experienced long-term investors are a little more sanguine about this and saying, no, well, maybe this time, you know, we are actually in for a considerable correction, and this was a bear rally, and it's going to actually reverse, and we're going to see prices fall another 20% or maybe even 30% from where they are. Very interesting to see how it plays out. But I still believe that a lot of retail investors risk losing their shirts, and they don't really see it coming.
No, and Jeremy Grantham, I think it was, made a very interesting point about this the other day about the market. And he said that basically, in his view, we are heading for something between the 2000 tech crash and a rerun of the early 1930s, which was, falling stock prices. So, and falling in a big way. So, I really do wonder, where we're going to end up in that regard, if it's just going to be contained to the market or if it's going to turn into something else more broadly, just because, there is just the market is just so big and just so much cash has flowed into it. And the truth is, like, I honestly don't know where things will end up with earnings. Things could fall off an absolute cliff like they did in 2008. And, and if you've got that and the Fed tightening into a recession like it's 1973, I don't even know where that particular story ends.
No, but it is interesting. Grantham basically said, look, the super bubble is not over, right? And the correction we've had so far isn't sufficient to deal with the super bubble. So therefore, this is going to play out with stocks more to the downside. And then, as you say, he said, but I'm not sure yet how far it's going to fall, whether it's going to be, one end of the spectrum, the other end of the spectrum. But we're not out of the super bubble yet. We're still ridiculously priced. And therefore, the downside is much more likely than the upside from here, which I thought was pretty interesting. Now, of course, he does tend to be a little bit on the bearish side, but he has actually called it right through Japan and through the tech wreck. So, you have to listen to what he says.
I find the thing with Grantham is he's at times he's bearish early, but he tends to be right about these things eventually. It's just a question of when. But I mean, that's the everything with market. With markets, everyone can go, oh, there's going to be a bear market or there's going to be a bull market, and eventually you'll be right. It's just what happens in the meantime.
Yeah, it's all about timing, isn't it? As you say, what happens in the meantime? Yep, absolutely.
This I thought was a really interesting little slide because it shows that there is going to be an estimated 350,000 jobs reshored, so brought from overseas back to the United States in during 2022. Now, 350,000 jobs is a very solid non-farm payrolls month during a the growth of the labor market. So that is an entire, more than arguably more than an entire month's worth of solid jobs growth just from bringing jobs home. So I think, if these geopolitical issues continue and you do start to see the regionalization of supply chains, you start to see factories coming back to the US, I think it's entirely possible that this could continue to underpin, at the very least, a better labor market than otherwise would have been expected.
Yeah, absolutely. And, even here in Australia, there's some talk about bringing jobs back on shore. 195,000 new skilled migrants might be part of that story, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that's not quite bringing jobs back in the same way, is it? That's just bringing in more people and then hoping to find a job for them. So,
Well,
oh.
maybe, but that we yeah, but you have to say that it's all part of a story of the global dynamic in terms of outsourcing jobs to the lowest possible country does seem to be reversing.
Well, and that, as they say, is inflation. Is will be inflationary. It's going to cost money to build these factories. It's going to cost money to pay these people higher wages than would otherwise be paid in other countries. I mean, maybe in time, once you start building these big automated factories, et cetera, yes, the costs will drop off. But in the meantime, you've got to build the factories, you've got to automate the factories, and all that costs money.
Yeah, begs the question, what does that do to productivity? I'm not necessarily as convinced as some that this is actually going to be positive for productivity. And in fact, productivity is probably one of the big issues that nobody really wants to tackle, right? Because you can bring jobs back on shore in Australia, but how efficient are we? And the productivity really has been very bad for a generation, frankly.
Well, maybe we're measuring productivity wrong. We should be doing it based on how many houses that we're capable of selling each other, and what price. I mean, if we just change the metric, if they can change metrics, why can't we? Change the
Absolutely.
metric.
Yeah.
Therefore, we are the most productive country in the world.
Absolutely right. Well, yes, that's right. How many houses per capita, what biggest proportion of income going on property? Those could be seen as new positive metrics, and then we'd be fine. We'd be right up there.
Yeah, well, exactly. We could change it from percentage of disposable income spent on housing to happiness index. The higher it goes, the happier the people
Yeah, absolutely. We should make write a paper on it.
are. All right. Last slide for the day. We actually got through this in a reasonable time today. This is US job openings. Now, while, as you can see, it has rolled over somewhat from its peaks, it actually bounced in its last outing, which surprised few people to the upside by almost 800,000 jobs a month, which is really quite something. But I think the thing that's worth noting the most is the fact that we are still about 4 million jobs a month higher than what we were prior to the pandemic. And I think that really speaks volumes about how long it's going to take for the US labor market to roll over. Now, the JOLTS index, which is this particular index, which is, job openings and et cetera, this is generally considered to be one of the better leading indicators for the US labor market. Now, you can see that it actually peaked, if you're talking about pre-COVID terms, that it actually peaked in 2018. And that basically, for a lot of people who follow this thing at a macroeconomic level, that signaled that the US was basically heading for a recession in the next couple of years, that it was going to be this slow decline. 2020, 2021, there was going to be a recession. But it just goes to show that how long these things can take to roll over under normal circumstances. Now, admittedly, these aren't normal circumstances, but even if it rolls over twice or even three times as quickly, you're still talking about 7, 8, 9 months worth of data before it starts to get to a really, really challenging point. And then you've got to wait for this data to feed into the official payrolls data, which between, what's actually in 12 months' time, bar some sort of price, that we could still see hawkish central banks even in an economic downturn.
Yeah, and of course that was really one of the themes again from Jackson Hole that they recognised that that may be the case. You know that we actually go on lifting rates. We want to see the inflation come down, but you know we've still got a strong jobs, strong economy, and so those two things are pulling in significantly different directions, which is why this is a very complex picture.
Well, I think one of the things that really spoke volumes recently was some of the comments by the Bank of England. They released this, frankly, somewhat disturbing forecast of how the Britain is going to have this sizable recession. It's going to be long, it's going to be difficult, and it's, quite possibly going to be the lowest fall in living standards for the British people in real terms since the Second World War. Yet then they turned around and they just said, and then we're going to do all these massive rate hikes. So I think that really sort of speaks to where their mindset is at. It's like, but the economy is going to detonate, and they're like, we don't care. We are going to raise interest rates because we need to kill inflation. And I mean, if you saw it see something like that from the Fed, people's heads are just going to explode.
Well, they did sort of say that inflation, you know, was the target, and they did make specifically the comment that the jobs market was very strong, and that it might have to come back a little bit before, you know, they'd solve the inflationary issue. So they knew potentially that there would be an impact, and nobody quite knows. And the other point, of course, is that you know, wages growth in the US is beginning to take off in some areas as well. So that's something else that they're going to have to think about. So this is, again, a very complicated situation, but if they do fixate on dealing with inflation and saying we've got to get inflation down to our target and we will go on lifting rates because that's the lever that they've got until such time as they do that, in the context of quantitative tightening, in the context of the where the wages and where the employment growth in the US is, and frankly, it's all to what the Fed does because everybody else just follows what the Fed does, really, I think. We're going to be for an interesting ride, which, by the way, won't just be a few months, but could be maybe 2, maybe 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all of these things are on the table. I mean, that crops up in, say, Europe early next year. They're like, let's just sort of, play out this that particular scenario. So there's a crisis in Europe early next year. There's some form of large scale intervention by the ECB. There's swap lines from the Fed. There's the full scaffolding put on the EU economy again. And obviously there's the associated downturn that you would see in China and everywhere else as a result of that. You know, that's sort of one of those sort of, you know, toward not worst case scenarios, but, you know, sort of scenario in that, you know, set of circumstances, it's entirely possible that the Fed could still be like, yeah, but, you know, all right, well, we'll stop raising rates, but we're not going to cut them. You know, maybe we'll do a bit of QE, but we're not going to cut them. You know, so like all these scenarios are well and truly on the table. And, you know, I think that in just more broadly, people are just expecting a return to just, we have crisis, Fed does QE, market goes to moon. And I don't think there's really any preparation for those, you know, shades of gray in between.
I agree. Shades of grey, isn't the market doing that very well actually at the moment? And you know, there are a lot of people pushing particular product sets for particular scenarios, and therefore they always have their particular viewpoint. I'm quite sceptical of a lot of these experts at the moment. And you know, the bottom line is this: there are so many variables and so many uncertainties, it's very hard to call. But what we got a very clear message from the Fed and from the other central banks is rates are going higher. So that has got to be the cornerstone anchor point around which you sort of build the scenarios out over the next, certainly, probably year plus. Rates are going higher. Property prices are going to fall. So, you know, as night follows day.
Well, CBA seems to disagree with you. You know, there was that thing put out to, I believe it was either yesterday or today, and, that, yep. And they're saying, you know, the RBA is going to get to 2.85, and then they're going to pause. Yep. Now, yep. I don't see it myself. You know, I mean, if the Fed raises by 0.75 at the end of September, as is expected, then, yeah, then you're talking about, you know, a 0.75% rise, and then, for, you know, the CBA is talking about that potentially being followed by 0.25 by the RBA list in 2 weeks later. I think that looks a little bit weak, and I don't think the bond market and the Australian dollar would like that very much.
No, well, so the markets aren't saying that that's where it's going to be, so we'll wait with interest to see. But, you know, standing back, the uncertainty principle is right before our very eyes, right? There are lots of things which are basically making it very difficult, very complicated to try and call anything at the moment. Lots of externalities like, you know, the gas price and the Ukraine situation, as well as China, you know, which we haven't touched on today, but China is also another situation. They've got more lockdowns in China, I noticed, looking at the latest data. So there's a lot of stuff out there. So, you know, very uncertain. But like I said, the cornerstone is the Fed is going to lift. And, you know, that really has got to set the agenda. So interesting times.
But we haven't touched on China. We haven't touched on the issues in Pakistan. We haven't touched on issues in EM. We haven't touched on the issues in Iraq, which could significantly impact the oil price. There is a laundry list of things that we can't touch on because there's just too much going on. And I think that that really just speaks to the issue that we face here. And you're 100% certain that X, Y, and Z is going to happen.
Well, Tarek, I appreciate your time today. That's a very interesting conversation. We had a few battles with the old internet today. So there'll be a few tweaks and edits in the show. And apologies to you folks out there listening, because there will be a few shaggy bits. But nevertheless, good work. Thanks for the slides. And we'll do it all again.
I'm looking forward to it, mate. You know, there'll be in a couple of weeks' time, there'll be plenty more to talk about.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Take care. Have a good weekend. See ya.
You too, mate. Bye.